Court will proceed to the fourth case, the United States versus Panzier. Mr. Shannon?
May it please the court.
Counsel?
Your Honors, this is a criminal case with a long procedural history. As the court is aware, the original arraignment in this case took place in January 27th of 2006. During the first trial that took place, which was a bench trial before Judge Griesbach in Green Bay, Mr. Panzier was representing himself pro se. On October 10th, 2006, after the court had entered guilty findings on count 1 through 9 and reserved ruling on the remainder of the indictment, Judge Griesbach recused himself. From October 10th, 2006 until December 13th of 2006, when Mr. Panzier sent a letter to the district court asking about his bond, nothing in this case took place. On December 26, 2006, is when the first time the government filed a motion to revoke Mr. Panzer's bond and stated that they wished for a retrial in this matter. Now, one thing to put before this court before I get into the argument, it wasn't until February 27, 2007, that Mr. Panzer actually renewed his motions in front of Judge Clifford, and that can be found in the record at 127. There are multiple issues that we raised before this court, specifically four. Whether or not the court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Panzer's speedy trial motion to dismiss, whether or not count one of the indictment was duplicitous, whether or not counts 2 through 9 contain sufficient elements for the charges, and whether or not Mr. Kerr, who was an expert for the government, was properly allowed to testify. Unless there's questions on the other three issues, I'd like to focus this court's attention first on the speedy trial issue, because I think there's multiple things that took place, and I think this court needs to decide what happens after the end of the first trial and before Judge Clifford makes a decision to deny the speedy trial. And the defendant says there's three possible things that took place after the October 10, 2006 recusal. The first is that the case is in limbo until we get to the letter written by Mr. Panzer on December 13th.
Yeah, but Judge Griesbach, in his order for recusal, revised the 13 pending pretrial motions and excluded 30 days.
Judge, I don't believe it was Judge Griesbach who did that. What happened?
I didn't mean Judge Griesbach, but because of the recusal, 13 pretrial motions were back on the table.
Well, Judge, that's important.
And that was excluded, and that time was excluded for at least 30 days.
Well, that finding was made by Judge Clifford
right.
Sometime later, but Judge, there's a question of whether or not those 13 motions automatically become as filed new, because there's an issue. The question of when does the clock reset? Is it at the time that of the act that caused a new trial, or when the new trial is set? Now, in the Seventh Circuit, I was unable to find a case that says what causes the triggering of the new clock. However, in the Ninth Circuit, U.S. versus Crooks, it says it's not the act of the mistrial, it's at the setting of the new trial that causes that clock to start. One of the issues we raise in our brief before this court is you can look at whether or not there was a 70-day violation from from October 10th to the first time Mr. Panzer sends in the letter on December 13th. But one of the other things that we put forth before this court is you can take into consideration, because Judge Griesbach did not set this case for a new trial. Rather, he just recused himself. So does that put Mr. Panzer back in the position as he was before the trial started? Or does it restart the clock, which is what usually happens when there's a remand from the appellate court? It's our argument that this court should follow U.S. versus Crooks, where it says this restarting of the clock does not happen until the trial is reset. The trial was not reset. Actually, nothing took place in this case. There was not an order from the court saying that they're taking motions under advisement when Judge Clifford got the case after October 10th. There was no motion ordering the government to respond to the pending, if there were pending motions. In fact, when Judge Griesbach decided these motions, the government didn't even respond to the majority of the motions. So there's an issue of whether or not this clock actually resets itself just because Judge Griesbach recused himself, or does it reset itself when Judge Clifford finally made a finding on December 13th? At that point, the 70 days is long gone. But even if we look at the time frame from October 10th, 2006, which is when the recusal occurs, all the way until December 13th, 72 days have gone by. Now, Judge Clifford says that the 30 days under advisement for motions is the basis to find that 70 days has not expired. In fact, he uses those 30 days to find that only 59 days have expired. But the question before the court is, what was under advisement? There was no order indicating that the motions had been revived. In fact, it wasn't until February 27, 2007, in front of Judge Clifford, does Mr. Panzer says, yeah, I'm reviving my motions.
Well, they weren't withdrawn at any time before.
They weren't withdrawn, Judge. But
if they're not withdrawn, weren't they pending?
Well, Judge, if they were pending, then we have to include the time back from when Judge Griesbach had this case. Because if it's not a new trial, if it's a new trial, he would have to refile those motions. Let's say it was sent back to the appellate court on remand for a new trial. He would have to refile those motions and say, I want to proceed on these motions. That didn't happen here. There was no remand. What had happened here is there's a recusal. So if the motions are pending at that time, at the point of when there's a recusal, then this court would have to include the time as when they were pending when Judge Griesbach had the case. Judge Griesbach never set this for a new trial. He recused himself and sent it to the district court in Milwaukee because it needed to be transferred. There is nothing there tolling the time because the trial had never been reset. So if you take into consideration the 70 days that expired before the first trial and then add on, even if you exclude those 30 days that Judge Clavert wants to exclude from October 10th to December, those 30 days, there's still a violation of the Speedy Trial Act because more than 7 days of non-excludable time has expired. As we set forth in our brief, there's a section where we show how many days in the first trial, before the first trial, were non-excludable days. And then if you count the 59 days that Judge Clavert to be found not excludable, we're well beyond the 70 days. Judge Williams, I think what you're asking is, why doesn't the clock start anew as soon as he recuses himself? The one case that we're able to find says that it doesn't start anew until the retrial is set, not the act that causes the retrial to happen. So two things happen. Either the case was entirely reset, which would then require Mr. Panzer to file the motions anew, which on February 27th is when the first time he says, I renew those motions. Or if the case was placed back in the same position as it was prior to the first trial, as Your Honor, Judge Flom has said, aren't they still pending? Well, if they're still pending, that means no action took place on them, and they were filed back in 2006. So that excludable time should count also. The third thing that's possible in this case, which the defendant puts forth, is the fact that nothing really happened between October 10th and December 13th when it was the defendant who made the first proactive filing in this matter to ask what was going on in his bond. And Judge Clavert relies on Section J of 18 U.S.C. 3161 to say that for 30 days can be excluded because the case was under advisement. But the question is, what's under advisement? He relies that the pretrial motions are under advisement. However, again, it's not until February that the defendant says, yes, I'm renewing my motions. What else could be under advisement? If the motions are not pending at that point because this is a new setting for trial, there was nothing else pending before the court. Now, even though the court may have needed time to review the file to see how complex it was, the question was that a reasonable justification of time under Section F?
Well, Judge Griesbach, in his recusal order, vacated not only the judgment that he had previously entered, but all of his previous orders in the case.
Except for the bond, correct.
Right. So wasn't Judge Clavert entitled and within his discretion to construe that act as having revived all the pretrial motions? He needed to address them?
But based on your scenario, Judge, that would be a resetting of the actual case. Because what happens is when Judge Griesbach recuses himself, he doesn't set the case for retrial. And the question is what...
Well, he can't once he recuses.
He can't. So then the question is, does the district court where the case gets transferred to need to restart the speedy trial clock? The question is, does the speedy trial clock stop or toll itself automatically just because Judge Griesbach recused himself? And there's no case law to support that. It automatically stops based on a recusal. So if
where are you coming up with this requirement that the district court has to do something affirmatively to restart the clock?
Judge, we're relying on a Ninth Circuit case. I couldn't find anything on the Seventh Circuit. It's U.S. versus Crooks, which we cite in our brief, which I know is not binding upon this court. But this court can take a look at it if there's nothing in this circuit. But in U.S.
Yeah, and even in that case, we didn't have a situation like here where the whole reason that Griesbach recused was on the motion recused was because the defendant in the criminal case sued him civilly in the civil case. I mean,
Judge Griesbach was not the person sued. What had happened, Your Honor, was there was a witness who was a judge in the first trial who also testified in the second. It was a state court judge. It turned out after the trial, Judge Griesbach made it known to both parties that he was friends with that
right.
judge and then gave the parties options to file briefing for recusal.
Right. I misspoke on that. But the point is that that was generated by action by the defendant. I mean, the whole scenario of the recusal
was generated by the judge giving them the option.
Right.
And Mr. Panzer said, yes, I request that you recuse yourself.
Right. And
correct.
So once he agreed to that, I'm just saying that Crooks is very different from this situation that we have here.
The factual situation, but I agree, is different. I think this is a very unique kind of case in what the procedural history of this case
and
is.
And hasn't the Ninth Circuit limited the import of Crooks anyway?
Under what circumstance, Judge?
In the Pittner case?
Talking about when the trial clock actually starts?
Right.
Well, Judge, I believe, but if you look at Pittner, it still follows the theory of the fact. The question is, when does the clock restart? And, Judge, I see I'm running out of time. Would you like to finish addressing?
Please.
I think the question becomes the difference is, in Cooks, it discusses what is the triggering effect of the new clock. And I think if you look at Pittner, it doesn't really address the triggering effect. But if you look at our case, what fact causes Judge Clover to find that a new clock has started? That's the question, I believe. If there's no other further questions, I'll save the rest of my time for you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Senne. Ms. Hoffman.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Gail Hoffman. I represented the United States of America at all of the lower court proceedings in this case. Just briefly, in terms of the first trial in front of Judge Griesbach, the defendant appeared pro se at that point in time. Judge Griesbach did lay out his friendship with Judge Atkinson, which was the basis for ultimately Judge Griesbach's recusal. The trial went forward, and then upon further reflection, the judge thought that discretion was the better part of valor and elaborated on his friendship. And at that point in time, the parties were given the option of whether to request the judge's recusal. The government did not request the judge's recusal. Mr. Panzer did, which led to the recusal order, which brought the case then from the Green Bay District down to Milwaukee, and it was assigned randomly to Judge Clavert. This case had many motions that were filed. It had a somewhat different history than the normal case in terms of the motions that were filed. The motions were unique. The indictment was a 31-count indictment. When the case was received by Judge Clavert was entitled to a period of time, 30 days, to review the pending motions and to make a determination. What counsel neglected to mention in terms of the period from October 10th, prior to December 26th, is that in late November, early December, the defendant mailed to some of the witnesses, to myself, to the United States Attorney, to the judge, forms, OMB forms 1099, indicating that it's an IRS form, indicating that either Mr. or Mrs. Panzer had paid some roughly around $1 million to the witnesses, to myself, to the U.S. attorney. And so in order to prove that they were actually submitted to the IRS, some research was necessary in order to obtain record of the actual filing. That was taking place prior to the motion to revoke the defendant's bond. Once those ducks were in order, so to speak, the government filed the motion to revoke the defendant's bond. Judge Griesbach, after issuing verdicts of guilty on counts 1 through 9, had admonished the defendant that any further filings of false form would result in the revocation of his bond. However, he had recused himself, and the case was viewed anew by Judge Clavert. It's the government's position that 3161 sub E is clear. The action occasioning the trial shall commence within 70 days from the date the action occasioning the retrial becomes final. In this case, it's the order of recusal. The Crooks case cited by Panzer's counsel is not applicable to the instant case. That case involved an interlocutory appeal. The court specifically said, and here was what the issue was in that case, in Crooks on page 1145, the case says, appellants argued that the 28-day period between the dismissal of the jury and the first trial and the entry on October 24, 1983, the order setting their retail trial should be included in calculating the speedy trial period. This argue is meritless. The district court's order, not the dismissal of the jury, constituted the action occasioning the new trial. So my position is that that case is pretty much limited to the specific facts involved in the Crooks case, and that was a specific issue that led to the court's finding on that particular statement. It's the government's position, as the district court correctly found, that only 59 days had elapsed and that the case was brought to trial within the 70-day period, and unless the court has any questions, the government rests on its submissions.
Thank you.
Your Honors, it's the government's position that the trial started anew. If the trial starts anew, it is Mr. Panzer's duty then to refile the motions. And it's not until February 27th, more than 70 days have passed, before he tells the court that he wants to renew those motions. By that point, the speedy trial clock has elapsed.
How does that come about, that February refiling? Was it an inquiry from the court? Are these motions still alive? Do you want it? I mean, what were the mechanics of that?
Judge, procedurally what happened was after the government had filed a motion to revoke, the Judge Clavert set this matter down for a hearing. That took us into January. He was then detained, and then there were several statuses because he was a pro se defendant until that point. I didn't come into the case until sometime in March, when then we responded to the pending motions. Your Honor takes a look, and if you base it on Judge Clavert's, he says that the motions are under advisement. The replies and the responses to these motions were not even due until March. So if they're under advisement for 30 days during that time period, why weren't responses and replies due back then? It's because they weren't under advisement. It wasn't until prior to myself being retained by the Panzers to represent Mr. Panzer at trial is when briefing of these motions. And if you look at the government's argument, these were complex motions. The first time they were filed, they didn't respond to many of them. In fact, Judge Griesbach just denied them on his own. So that's what took us to February. It was the first issue was the bond revocation issue, which took place in January. Then there were statuses that followed that time. But, judges, if you follow the government's theory that this is a new trial, therefore the clock starts over, there are no motions pending, and therefore Judge Clavert abuses discretion in excluding the first 30 days. Because by February, if you go from October 20th all the way till February 27th, if this is a new trial, and the clock has started new, Mr. Panzer does not file those motions during those 30 days. And for that reason, based on the speedy trial violation, we ask this case be remanded. And because there is prejudice to this defendant, because the statute of limitations would have run, this case should be dismissed.
Thank you, Mr. Sandin. Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.